This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is soul singer Solomon Burke, who was known as the King of Rock and Soul in the 60s. He played that title to the hilt and performed in a jeweled crown with a robe and a scepter. Solomon Burke is one of the singers who led the rise of soul music in the 60s. In fact, Peter Guralnick's book, Sweet Soul Music, attributes Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records as saying that Solomon Burke's hits kept Atlantic alive from 1961 to 64. These hits included Just Out of Reach and The Price. Burke was a preacher long before he became a soul music star. He grew up in Philadelphia, where he started preaching at age 7 and conducted a radio ministry when he was 12. In the 1970s, after his string of hits, when he was disillusioned with the music industry, Burke founded his own church and recorded only gospel music. But now he's making a soul music comeback. This is the title song from his recent album on Rounder Records, A Change Is Gonna Come.
I was born by the river in a little tent, just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. Oh, yes, it is. It's been too hard living, and I don't wanna die. I don't know what's up there beyond the skies, but it's been a long time coming. But people, let me tell you, a change is gonna come. Oh yes it is, oh yes it is, oh yes it is.
Solomon Burke made his first records for the Apollo label. When he left them, he also gave up the music business. He told me he was studying to be a mortician and working at his uncle's funeral parlor when Atlantic Records tried to sign him.
I was working at the mortuary at Barclays Funeral Home, and I met this gentleman named Sam Goldberg, who wanted me to go back into show business. And I said, Sam, I'm not going to get into show business. Forget it. He says, some kind of way, I got to get you back into show business. He introduced me to another gentleman by the name of Babe Sivian. Babe Sivian was a very big, handsome guy, very interested in show business. And he came to the funeral home one time, and he says, there's nothing we can do to get you in show business. There's nothing. And I says, I'm going to stick here at the funeral home. I've got an apartment. I've got it made. You know, I'm going to be a funeral director any minute. Nothing. Forget it. So 2 weeks later, he called me back up. He says, if we give you $4,000 to record one song, could you do it? I says, no way. Forget about it. I said, well, you guys, just leave me alone. You know, I'm really trying to hang in here. A month later, they brought a red convertible Lincoln and set it in front of the mortuary. For 2 days, nobody in the community knew whose car this was. And we got a phone call, and my aunt says, somebody's got to move that car away from this funeral home. This is embarrassing. You can't have a red convertible Lincoln sitting in front of a black mortuary. It's just impossible. You got to move it. Somebody's got to move it. We have to call a tow truck and have it moved. So Babe called, and he says, oh, that car is yours. It's sitting in front of the... All you have to do is just get in and drive it away, and you'll be in show business. And I says, I can't believe this guy. So seriously enough, the keys were in the glove compartment. I took the car, drove it around the block, and called him back. And I says, you got to come get this car. And he came by, and he talked to me. He says, just go in and make one record for us. You make one record, everything. If it doesn't work, we'll turn it around. That was the beginning of my career of getting back into show business. We made one record for his label called Singular Records, and Babe and Artie took the record. And then from there, we went to Atlantic Records, and that was the beginning of the new Solomon Burke in the 60s era.
You recorded something called The Price for Atlantic Records.
Classic.
It's a great record.
Classic.
And you really sound like a preacher on it. I mean, the beginning sounds to me like great preaching.
I am the preacher.
So it made me think that, yeah, there really was a connection between what you were doing as a preacher and what you were doing as a singer.
Well, it certainly is. The connection is that my ministry never stops, and I have taken my songs and put it into my ministry, and I've taken my ministry and put it into my songs
I want to play The Price. Do you want to say anything about the day you recorded this or your memories of the session?
The day The Price was made, it was recorded first live on the stage at the Apollo Theater. And the band had no idea of what we were doing, so I told them to keep repeating what they were playing and don't stop. And I personally had had some personal problems with my life. And I came on stage and I was very furious. And I just went on almost in a rage. And I started singing this song. And I realized that I had given up so much for the love of one woman. And my love life was being crushed at that point. That was a day that a lady fell out of the balcony after listening to this song. And the guy backstage, Mr. Henry, came back and says, "God, you should record that song. I never heard it on any of your recordings." And we went and recorded the song 2 days later. And it was a price. And today it's a classic. Millions of people, when they ask me to sing it today, sometimes I refuse. It depends on how I feel. But The Price is such a true song, because if you've ever been in love and you've ever been hurt by love, you realize the price you pay. It's not easy.
Let's hear it.
After I hung up my heart for you, darling, and I said if you ever need me, all you had to do was call me. I stood up and I told the whole wide world that you were good for me, baby. Yes, then you laughed and you called me your personal clown in front of all your friends. You walked away and you left me standing up like a fool. I couldn't even go to my friends or my relations. All I could do was stand up and hang my head in shame. You see what you cost me? You cost me my mother, love of my father, sister, Lord, my brother too. Oh yes you did. You see now what you've caused, and I know just what I've lost, and I know what the price I paid. I paid, I paid for loving someone like you. I can hear my friend say, "I told you, I told you," and I can hear my mother say, "Fool, I told you." You see what you? Oh yes, you do. You look back and you wonder sometimes. My, 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 my. And I see the price I paid. I paid for loving someone, 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 someone like you, baby. And I don't care what the world might say, I'm gonna love you any old way. And although you let me down, baby, my, 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 deep down in my heart I feel there's nobody else but you. And I don't care what my mother, my father might say.
It's my guest Solomon Burke in his recording The Price as recorded in the early 1960s. Before we heard it, you said that you're asked to sing it a lot, but you won't.
A lot of times I don't sing it.
Why? No. Why wouldn't you sing it?
Because personally, it still affects me emotionally. I immediately flash back to the period of the time the song was written and the problems that I was going through personally. And I still feel the hurt. I still feel the pain sometimes. And if I would get into it, it would be too much. I would probably over-dramatize it. So I go to something else, like, Love Trap or something, to get out of it. You know, it's a very personal song.
When you got to Atlantic Records, in a way, they didn't know what to do with you.
None whatsoever.
And so they were giving you songs. You were used to singing your own songs, but they were giving you songs. And they gave you some country-oriented songs.
They gave
songs.
Me some country songs. Jerry Wexler said, well, here's some songs. You go home and listen to them, see what you can do with them, and call us back and let us know what key you might want to sing them in. And we come back and we'll get it together. And we called them back a couple of weeks and we told them the keys. And they says, okay, we're going to give you a date. Come back and we'll cut some tracks and see what happens. When we came in and the music started playing, and everybody was sitting there saying, well, this won't be long, you know. What, this guy's not going to do that with these. And we did Just Out of Reach of My Tempting Arms. And the first time Jerry Wexler stopped the tape, and he says, you can't talk in there. You know, the talking doesn't go. I just want you to sing it straight through. And I says, I'm sorry, Mr. Wexler. I can't sing it straight through. I feel the talking. So he says, okay, go ahead. And when the record was released, it took a year for the record to happen. And I always feel that the reason why it took a year for the record to happen with such a great record company was that Jerry Wexler was still very angry that I talked in that record. And the secret of the record was that it was just the feeling of the record. And Just Out of Reach became the first country and western song ever recorded by a black artist to cross over into the charts and to ever establish a black artist as a country singer.
I want to just play an excerpt of Just Out of Reach.
Oh, so, I love it.
So people can hear how you sound doing that. Oh, okay. This is Solomon Burke singing Just Out of Reach, which is the country song that he mentioned that he was recording.
Just out of reach. That runs away from me, dreams that just won't let me be, blues that keeps on bothering me, chains that just won't set me free, too far away from you and all your charm. Just out of reach of my two empty arms. Each night in dreams I see your face. Memories time cannot.
Some feeling all the time, knowing you cannot be mine. Dreams that hurt me, that torture me late at night in my sleep. Vows and promises you swore that just you and I alone could only keep. That's the part that upset Jerry Wexler. Sing it, don't talk it. Talking it made it a million seller, and talking has made it a classic, and now that same record has sold over 15 million by itself, with myself and many other artists across the country. It is a classic.
How did you feel when you got into the studio and there were this chorus of voices
the
for
Ray
you
Charles
to sing?
Singers, the classic Ray Charles singers, and everybody was laughing and smirking. You know, this is, we're not going to have this guy in here long. You know, once he get in this, it's going to be the end of it. And Jerry Wexler will live out his agreement with this guy. That's it.
Because a lot of people were introduced to it probably on country music stations, did they assume that you were white since there were no black artists who were on the country charts?
Well, the joke was that no black station would play it either, okay, because they couldn't classify it. It wasn't rhythm and blues, and as you've heard it, it wasn't rhythm and blues, and it certainly wasn't rock and roll, and the country stations wouldn't play it because I was black. So they just didn't know what to do with it. And the Gene Autry people who owned Four Star Music, who owned the song, they called me in Los Angeles and talked to me and said, the record's been out a year, and we really would like to see this record happen. And I'm informed that Mr. Autry is going to put it on five of his stations. So within a couple of weeks, we'll see if the record really has it or not. And within 5 or 6 weeks, we found out that the record had it. It was a blessing. It was a gift from God.
So did some people assume that you were white?
Yes, I had a lot of fun. great experiences with that. One incident, we were given an award in a little city in Mississippi, and I got to the performance, and my band was there, and and the sheriff and everybody were so glad to see us, and they welcomed us in town and everything, and they kept asking me, what time is my boss going to get there? And I couldn't figure it out. You know, I figured, well, which one? And they says, you know, the big boss. And I said, well, I guess, you know, if the big boss is coming, I mean, I didn't know Jerry Wexler would come to a little town like this or something like that, but if him or Babe Sivian was coming, I mean, it should be any minute. You know, they know more than me. You know, they know what time the planes land. I don't. And I kept waiting. They kept waiting. We kept waiting. The guy says, you guys, you boys got to go on. I says, we're ready. You know, we're ready to go on. And so he says, when's that Solomon Burke going to get here? I said, Solomon Burke? I said, we got a big problem. I'm Solomon Burke. He said, no, you better not be Solomon Burke. I said, I'm Solomon Burke, man. He said, sing a note right now. I said, you will prove to me. Show me some ID. And I showed him my little Social Security card and his little pictures. And boy, the guy started screaming. And he said, Evelyn, you better get in here fast. You're through. And he was screaming, and the sheriff was screaming, and people were running around. And says, what happened? And they locked us in the dressing room, wouldn't let us out. And he said, I want a sheriff on this door. And he got a guard on the door. It was a funny bit. It was unbelievable. We were terrified. We didn't know what was happening. I didn't know if Jerry Wexler had shot somebody or Babe Sivian had beat up Jerry Wexler. I didn't know what had happened. And here we are locked in this dressing room, and this concert of people are hollering, Solomon Burke. You know, you could hear it. And I said, what's going on? And the band said, what do we do? I said, I don't know. And the guy comes back in. He says, which one of you guys is supposed to be Solomon Burke? I says, I am. He says, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. He said, no, you're not. And it was got to a point where we're playing, no, you're not, yes, I am. He says, sing a little bit of Travel On. And I said, are you kidding? You know, well, I said, who gives the money? You know, who pays the money? This is what I want to. He says, I pay the money. I want to hear if you. So I said, well, okay. You know, for him, we're in dressing room. I said, okay, give me the guitar. And I start singing, and I feel like I've got to travel on. He said, oh, my God. And he slammed the doors and locked that door. Don't let him out. Hold the folks. And I said, God, what's happening? Next thing we knew, doctor came in. He says, it's going to be all right, boys. Just got a little short problem. Said, we're going to bandage you up a little bit. I said, bandage me up? He says, it's been a big mistake. Say, you haven't heard it. Said, it's the funniest thing ever happened in this town. He said, you're supposed to be white. So today you're going to be in white bandages. And you boys going to go on out there and play. And you're going to sing. And then we're going to give you the trophy. Then we're going to get you the hell out of town as fast as we can.
So they bandaged you up so no one could tell you were black? Up.
But that's what happened. It was a great day.
So what did the audience think? They were expecting to see a white man. No one believed you were Solomon Burke.
They saw the band. You know, the band wasn't white. It didn't make any difference. You know, I got out there and sang, and they apologized for me having an accident, and I could only sing a few songs, and I sung Just Out of Reach, and He'll Have to Go, and A Tear Fell, and that was it. And everybody was happy, and I sung Just Out of Reach again. And then they says, he can't sing too much now, boys. I tell you, the man just had to have you see him all bandaged up. And they got me in the sheriff's car, got us to the airport, and got us on a private plane, and flew us into Memphis, Tennessee.
Did that change the way you made arrangements anywhere? Did anyone say?
It certainly did. We made sure that everybody knew that we were the only black artist singing country and western. Please remember, this guy's a black cowboy. You got to understand that. And we start telling, matter of fact, I start wearing a big cowboy hat so people would know immediately. And then we printed it on our bus, you know, Solomon Burke, you know, Just Out of Reach, you know, so people would know.
What'd you like about the term soul to describe your music as opposed to R&B? You said you really didn't like the idea of being on the R&B charts and having your music called R&B.
Well, R&B represented rhythm and blues. I was born with rhythm. I just wasn't born with the blues.
I guess R&B in a way was just a code word for black.
R&B was the code word for black. If you were an R&B artist, the funny thing is there was two charts. There was the rhythm and blues charts, and there was the regular top 100 charts. And the funny thing about the R&B charts is it always started at 110, 151, you know, and then you'd have to work your way up from 151, and you became number one on the R&B charts. Then you got to be on the top 100 charts with a red bullet at 99. And you could get a chance to go up all the way over again.
There was actually a coronation ceremony for you where you were coronated the King of Rock and Soul.
Yes,
right?
we've had three of them. But the original one was in Baltimore. Rockin' Robin brought me into Baltimore to the Royal Theater. And on that show, it was the first performance, which is really history. And every time Diana Ross sees me, she mentions it. It was her first performance, her first show. And we had the Marvelettes. And the Supremes, a new group called the Supremes. And we were crowned the King of Rock and Soul.
Did you actually dress in kingly garments for your performances?
Still do.
What do you wear?
Well, we have maybe 10 or 15 different robes, royal, regal robes. Some are probably too expensive to even wear on stage. The insurance companies won't allow us to wear two or three of them anymore. And we would wear the robes, and then the crown was made up in England. And a lot of stories about that, too.
And was it a jewel-studded crown?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can't do a crown any other way, you know. It has to be right. And it was right. It was a copy from the crown, from the royal crown, the king's crown. Matter of fact, King Henry VIII's crown. And it was fun. It was really fun. We'd put it on, and we'd come in a crown case. And we had a case, an old wig box was all converted and lined with velvet. And we'd have a little midget who used to travel with me, sing like Sam Cooke. And he would walk behind me, and when I would throw the robe off, he would walk off the stage, and you can actually see the robe moving by itself, you know, right off the stage.
So you still wear things like that
now?
We
still wear the robe, and we bring it out for certain occasions, special occasions, because people long to see that, you know. Other people say, you know, did you ever see Solomon with the robe and the crown? And did you ever see him when they rolled out the carpet and the whole thing? And they come to see that. They actually want to see that.
Can you tell the story of the performance during which James Brown wanted to get the crown away from you?
Fascinating story. Well, it was a beautiful situation. We were in Chicago, Illinois. I was booked on a James Brown show through Universal Attractions. And with my band, this is what was so unbelievable. James is a very beautiful person. And we were making a great salary, I think something like $5,000 for that one performance in Chicago. And then in those times, that was a lot of money for a black artist with your band. And we got there on time and everything, because when you're working with James Brown, you got to be on time and you got to show up for the whole thing. It's like an army drill, right? And we got there and we did everything. We checked into our dressing room. Everything was beautiful. And James says, "Where's your robe and crown?" And I says, right here." She says, "Oh, good. Make sure, as long as you got your robe and crown." I says, "Okay, fine, no problem." Then he called us, and I says, "Where's the band set up?" So "Don't worry about your band." Says, "I think Mr. Brown's going to let you use his band." So this is the organ player was telling me. I says, "Are you serious?" Says, "Oh, yeah." So they got everything down. Don't worry about it. So I said, "Well, fellas, you guys don't have to work. You just have to watch the show. So you can go out front and watch the show." And I told my guitar player, I says, "You better stand by, because maybe you have to go on with me." And it came time for me to go on, and they told me, "Mr. Brown's ready for you to come downstairs to the stage." I came downstairs and said, "Where's your robe and crown?" I says, "Right here." He says, "Okay, put it on. And I put it on. I'm waiting, and they got ready to call the next act, and they called the next act, and called the next act. And I said, "Well, I'm next. I know I'm next. I mean, I can't go on after James Brown. This is his show, and he's paying us, right?" And then the announcer says, "And now the man you've been waiting for." And I get ready because I know this is me, you know. And I see my carpet going rolling out, and everybody screaming. And I get ready to step out there. And then he says, "Mr. Dynamite himself, you know, so-and-so. Please, please, please." I said, "These guys make a mistake. I mean, James Brown." And I'm saying, "What? The king, the new king." I said, "What's going on?" And so James walks away and says, "I'm going to show you tonight who's king. You'll see who's king. Keep that crown and robe ready." And I said, "I can't believe this." You know, and I'm standing there, and I enjoyed myself for the first time in all those years of show business. I really enjoyed watching the show from backstage. I got the biggest thrill out of watching the James Brown show. And plus, I was getting paid $5,000 to watch it. And I watched the whole show. And then when it came time for the robe and crown, I went out and put it on him. I mean, for $5,000 a night, if a guy wants to wear a robe and crown, make sure you show up. And the only thing I said to him was, "James, listen, if you got some work for me the rest of the week, I'm open the rest of the week. You know what I mean? Anytime you need me, you can cut the price." And that was the story of it. I never sang. Never got a chance to sing. The people were screaming and hollering, "Solomon Burke, Solomon." Never sang. James closed the show, and that was it.
Did he give you the robe and the crown back after the performance?
Oh, he didn't have to give it back to me. We took it back.
Right.
But he went out the next week and got his own. So it was a great shot. I mean, I think it was more of the ego, the publicity that he wanted. Chicago was a very important city to him.
Why did you leave the music industry?
I was fed up. I was tired. I was tired of the deceit. I was tired of being misused and abused. I was tired of the games. And God gave me this talent. Man didn't give it to me, so man couldn't take it away from me. I went into California in 1968, and I called my mom here in Philadelphia, and I says, "Mom, I'm ready to come home." And she says, "No, son, don't do that. There's a big snowstorm in Philly." And this was in January, and I says, "Gee whiz, I'll just... The sun is shining out here. It's 100 and some degrees. And I'll stay out here until the snow comes over." Checked into a hotel, started looking around in California, loved it. Said, called back and told my mother, "I think I'm going to stay here another month for vacation." I'm still on vacation. I've been out on my vacation ever since 1968. We signed with MGM Records. MGM Records took us from records to movies, from movies to television. And it kind of got me out of the mainstream of the record business and into politics and into business and into more publishing and other exciting things.
Do you feel like a survivor?
I am a survivor. I am. I always consider myself as royalty in exile.
What do you mean?
Well, when you know, someone says, "You haven't had a hit record in so many years," I said, "It's no problem. You know, we'll have a hit record when God wills it or when it's the will of God. We don't need a hit record. What we'd like to have one, I'd like to have one every month, but it's not the idea of needing a hit record. Some artists must have a hit record to survive. By the grace of God, I'm going to survive through my educational background, through the knowledge and wisdom that was given to me by my parents and my grandmother, and through the spiritual knowledge and power of God. I'm going to survive. It doesn't make any difference. I'm going to live the way I want to live. I'm going to live good and prosperous. And my 21 children are going to be happy, and they're going to live. My 20 grandchildren, I hope I don't have any more yet, are going to, and if I do, I'd love it. They're going to live the way they want to live, and they're going to enjoy their life. And that's my way of thinking."
That was soul singer and preacher Solomon Burke. His recent albums include A Change Is Gonna Come on Rounder Records and Love Trap on Royalty Records. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.